Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover, everybody. What a great turnout. It's really a delight to welcome Ben Marcus. So let's welcome him. It's a wonderful book, and lots of excitement about it, as your presence attests to. So let's welcome Ben and hear the interesting things.
Thank you so much. I'm going to read from my new book, The Flame Alphabet, which came out last week. And it is about poisonous language that comes from children and makes adults sick. But it's really also about a family and what happens as a parent when the child you're supposed to love and protect is actually going to kill you through speech. So it's really meant to be a family story, and I want to read from early in the book. The narrator, Sam, and his wife Claire are sick at the beginning of the book, and they don't really know why. They're getting worse and worse. The doctors can't figure out what's going on. Their daughter, who's a teenager, goes away on a school trip, and they start to feel better while she's gone. And of course it dawns on them that they feel better because she's not there. And this is not a happy realization. Early on, though, some people are figuring out that, so parents are getting sick, but people without kids are not. And some of them figure out that they can kind of get a sort of toxic rush off of very limited exposure to children. And so there's a little subculture of groups who try to just get small doses of it, as people will seek out their drugs. So I'll read from early in the book, Sam, the narrator, and his wife, they think that they're better. They think that they might be feeling better in this section. Okay, everyone can hear all right? Okay. In Wisconsin, there were early adopters, a fiendish strain of childless adults who consumed the toxic language on purpose as a drug, destroying themselves under the flood of child speech. They stormed areas high in children, falling drunk inside cones of sound. They gorged themselves on the fence line of playgrounds where voice clouds blew hard enough to trigger a reaction, sharing exposure sites with each other by code. Later, these people were found dried out in parks, on the road, collapsed and hardening in their homes. They were found with the slightly smaller faces we would routinely see on victims in only a few weeks. Drifts of salt blew in from the west, blew out to sea, leaving bleached streets, trees abraded to pulp. Perhaps just a coincidence. Sometimes the driving was blind, and on the highways, blowers mounted to poles kept the roads clear. But at home, Claire woke up one morning and declared us cured. Esther was away at horse camp, her school's fall trip. They'd gone to Level Falls Farm, a four-figure getaway that promised intimate occasions with horses and the experts who baby them. Blood money paid out to stop the flow of Esther's demands for a few seconds. Money paid to her school, who we already paid, so they could take her away for a while, and we could fucking breathe. With Esther upstate, our days without exposure numbered four by now. Our health seemed to be flowing back, but there were hidden factors in play. We were ignorant of the illness plateau, the comprehension ratio we'd soon surpass. There were only so many words you could stand before you were done. About the child radius, we were naive. Naive is too mild a word for what we were. With this illness, signs of recovery were the trickiest symptoms of all. Feeling better was perhaps just a form of stunned disbelief, a shutting down. Maybe this was the quiet before the really fucking quiet. I think I feel better, Claire announced, sounding blurry. I'm definitely kicking this thing, said the half-dead person, I thought. It was remotely possible she was right, which isn't to say Claire wasn't capable of objective diagnostics, but that sometimes she suffered from spells of positive thinking. To prove her vigor, Claire cornered me sexually, made a physical trespass, seeking, it would seem, someone to leak on. But my body, pajama-clad and sweated out with enough blood to power only part of me, failed to cooperate. Her lips dragged across my back like a rough little claw. "What do you think?" she said. There was something forced to the way she kept rubbing, as if she wanted to get down to the bone. Claire's breath soaked into me, and she pitched her voice against my neck, speaking so closely to my body that only gibberish came out. This should have felt nice, but something sour hovered. "Want to?" "You mean now?" I stalled. "We could," she said, and her hand dropped, found my coldness, squished it inside her fist. There was no response. I rolled out of range. Claire never propositioned me, which on its own would be understandable. Language shouldn't be required for a married couple to toil for their grain of pleasure. But she never actually took off pants, mine or hers, or got the enabling oils or the towel. I guess that was supposed to be a man's work, or maybe only mine. She sent out clues and then waited for me to follow through, but often I did the reverse. Some days I was blind to the clues a little bit on purpose. In this case, I was hoping to wait for Thursday when we were at synagogue. The two of us in the woods after the broadcast had ended. In the hut with the cold air pouring in and the radio crackling in the background, it was easier to surrender to what sometimes, if we were exceptionally lucky, felt unterrible. Claire furrowed back into me, tugged too hard, and I swallowed some bile. Part of her on the wrong part of me was gritty and rough. There was a terrible smell in the air, most likely my own, and my groin was cold. It seemed as if what she gripped so fiercely might come loose in her hand. You guys are just completely quiet. It's so interesting. I read last night and everyone laughed through this whole scene, and you guys are like, this is not funny. It's not funny at all. It's not, actually. I tried to look at Claire, but her face was too close. "Should we later?" I said, hiding the apology in my voice. I sold the gambit with the most unbothered look I could manage. It was important that she not feel rejected. I noted, too, that sudden atypical sexual desire with predatory indicators was a clear symptom. But of what, I still wasn't sure. "I'm just so happy," Claire said, and her hug turned cozy, safe. "Wasn't I happy, too?" she wanted to know. "Wasn't I?" We hadn't been outside in days. We hadn't gotten dressed or done more than swish some cold water in our mouths, inhale a little bit of soup, maybe submit to the coarse body brush we treated each other to at bedtime. But bedtime seemed to be all day lately, and since today, with the contagion absent, we found ourselves moving faster and suddenly dressed for an outing. So we got in the car and took off for a black blanket picnic in our usual spot up on Tower Ledge. The field was quiet when we arrived, thoroughly childless. Some older couples wrapped in parkas and camp blankets huddled around their bread and jam. They suffered from the facial smallness. I tried not to stare. But people with shrunken features seemed short on time. It was like they were on their deathbeds. A ventilator chugged along on a carpet, churning liquid in its tank. Beneath a shawl, two women shared the mask, passing it back and forth without bothering to wipe it out between turns. As usual, some families had run extension cords up from their cars to power portable heaters, casting shimmering air over the field. You could walk through pockets of heat as if they had burst through a hole in the earth. In the field, no one sang, and if there was speech, it was whispered at levels too low to decode. People hummed in secretive tones, giving in to fits of coughing when their breath failed. When Claire and I walked through the grass looking for a dry patch where we might settle, picking our way through collapsed piles of people, we triggered ripples of silence in everyone we passed. No one wished to be overheard. But I didn't want the secrets of these strangers. I did not think I could bear them. The picnic tables, usually loaded with serving boats of communal food, were empty, except for traces of gauze rolls, some shredded medical supplies. Wrist straps and crumbled yellow tubing sat in the dirt. A fluid had dried and gone dark in streaks over the grass. It looked like the aftermath of an outdoor surgery. At the shaded end of the field where the sand run was installed, no little dogs tore back and forth, kicking up blizzards of sand. No dogs to be seen in the whole field. No dogs and no children. Over on the scorched cement pads, no one was shooting off rockets into the woods below. The public fire pit hadn't been cleaned from last time, and last time seemed like long ago. A mound of coals spilled over the rim of the hole, and the spit rod was still filthy with skin from what might have been the final cookout. The field was usually so crowded that family blankets met at their edges until the grass was covered in a great rug of black tufted wool. But today our rugs were scattered far apart, too few to ever connect, and we sat in distant rafts from each other, mostly out of earshot. I guess it's sort of cold, I offered, by way of a theory. Claire didn't second me. She must have also known that couldn't be it. We'd come here in weather far worse, and the field was packed with families. In the snow last year, we rolled our blanket over frozen grass. Someone built a fire inside an old iron lung, which got so hot it glowed. When the sun set in late afternoon, some elders launched from a slingshot hardened balls of birdseed, which ripped through the sky and occasionally got intercepted in dusty explosions by the bald sparrows that kept watching the trees and shot out when they saw food. It was not such a nice day, and there was illness in the field, but we decided to stay. We'd come all the way out here, and both of us dreaded being home again, where the house smelled of our own spoiled traces. Esther was coming back tonight, so at least today, for a little while in the field, we could spend our recovery out of doors with some people who were almost our own. The picnics were not strictly for the Jews of our neighborhood and maybe Bayside or Fort Wine, but they'd winnowed down that way. We were a community bound by an agreement to graze in the same field and enjoy the sight of each other. But beyond that, it needn't escalate. We used to bring our kids to these picnics as surrogate social agents, and the kids seemed to coagulate in some violent, anonymous way, even if the adults cuddled inside their own force fields and only said hello to one another. Hello was the perfect word. It began and ended all contact, delivering us into private chambers from which we could enjoy other people in textbook abstraction without the burden of intimacy. The kids would devour their food, then run off down the foot trail that dead ended in a wall of trees. Well, other people's kids. We used to bring Esther to the picnics, but she clung to us and sulked, building out a gloom that she somehow bloodied our own hands with, as if we created her moods in a lab and force-fed them to her every day, giving her no choice but to display feelings of our own authorship. The other kids formed a roving pack, moving like one of those clusters of birds that seem to share a single frantic brain. Claire and I would scout the kids for Esther, identifying girls her age, potential targets for friendship. "I like that girl's shoes," I'd say. And Esther wouldn't even look, just tell me that I should go talk to her if I liked her shoes so much. Is that how you captured Mom complimenting her footwear? "I didn't capture your mother," I said. "Not yet," smirked Claire. Kids approached Esther and asked her to play, but she politely declined, citing fatigue. Or she'd say, "No, thank you. I never really get to spend time with my parents," putting her head in her mother's lap. Claire accepted the affection, ulterior or not, and petted Esther's hair, careful not to push things too far. Last year, a gaunt, tall girl trespassed our blanket and asked, in the workshop tones of a second language, if Esther wanted to come see something. The girl smiled conspiratorially as if to suggest that Esther's idiotic parents could have no idea how brilliant this thing was that she was inviting Esther to see. Parents were creatures with ruined, insensate heads, and how could they ever be expected to appreciate the marvels of the Monastery Valley woods? What was it they'd found, a bucket of fresh, oiled genitals? When Esther declined, failing even to look intrigued, the girl ran off and was soon sucked into a cloud of children who plunged down the hill, shrieking. "Sweetie, I thought she seemed nice," Claire said. "Because she asked a question that makes her nice? That's a fairly low standard, Mom." "Well, because she was inviting you to join in, and that's a nice thing to do. She made an effort to include you. So if I try to coerce someone into doing something they don't want to do, then I'll be considered nice also?" This was Esther logic. It was formidable. "You guys wouldn't go running off with a pack of strangers," Esther said. "So why should I?" "It's fun," I ventured, bracing myself for her response. "Dad, can you name one time in your life when you suddenly ran off with a group of people you didn't know, screaming and laughing, simply because they were your age?" I looked down, hoping Esther would lower her voice, but it was true. I could not think of a single time. "I guess it's something you sort of stop doing when you get older," I admitted. Esther looked at me so hard I couldn't bear it. "So why can't I follow your example and never get involved in such practices in the first place? I'm not an animal. I don't follow people around simply because their asses smell good to me." I probably sighed. Certainly I expressed disappointment without speaking. It always surprised me when I didn't just stoop to Esther's level, but dug down below it, responding to her killing logic with sublingual ordnance. She watched my little performance, the facial codes I sent out to no avail. I saw her straining not to feel sorry for me. "This picnic would be more successful," said Esther, as if she were honestly trying to troubleshoot what had gone wrong, "if you guys gave up your urge to control me." "But where's the fun in that?" I said under my breath. Sometimes Esther appreciated these retorts. Not today. We were surrounded by other parents on the black rug, some of whom were overdoing their attempts to show they were not listening. Mostly they'd stop talking, staring into space as if some wind-borne peril had paralyzed them. "I think it's a perfectly successful picnic," Claire announced. "I'm having a terrific time. I really am." The word "really" showed up now and then in family conversations like these. We all clung to it. A desperate little adjective. Claire struggled to trust what she'd said. Perhaps she thought a voiceover would convince our audience. She had the amazing ability to conceal all evidence that she detected our prevailing moods, and if she ignored them, maybe those moods would vanish.
It is true that Claire's indifference to our despondency sometimes had a medical effect. Esther looked as if she had been studying our discussion for a class. Her face was blank. She'd fended off another friend, and perhaps in her world, with its new generation accounting, this was a point scored, another success. Down the ledge, an awful blast of laughter rose up from the children, but on our carpet we were quiet. Without Esther today, we tried not to trouble our few neighbors in the field by staring. No one wants to be seen asleep with a blood-cracked mouth. The ventilator chugged and the wind swept waves of dry warmth at us from the heaters. A hairless couple slept loudly on the carpet nearby, the wife's face erased beneath a white hospital mask. We ate and rested and we talked a little. Claire insisted that she felt fine. I wanted to believe her, but I felt scared deep in my body. This might have meant nothing. I could feel that way at the wrong times when things were fine, when I slept or even laughed, surges of fear that I'd learned to ignore. Eventually, you stop paying attention to your own feelings when there's nothing to be done about them. I wanted to tell Claire I was frightened, but it seemed like one of those remarks that would lead to trouble. Claire tucked some cookies in her mouth, moving them around with her tongue as if they had bones. I would have liked to believe in her recovery, but the evidence was impossible to ignore. On our carpet, Claire looked like one of those terminal patients let out of the hospital for a final field trip to her favorite restaurant, a ball game, a pity outing. She was thin and pale, and when she smiled, something dark shone from her mouth. I would not oppose what Claire claimed about herself or argue her from her position. So I said nothing of the bruising on her hands, the dried blood crisped over one of her ears. Instead, I scooted next to her and felt how little she was, how even through her coat I could feel the long cage of my wife's bones. When I hugged Claire, with sick people strewn in the field, I felt the shallow swell of her breath, and she seemed to me like a bellows that I could control, opening and closing her to the air of the world. I thought if I held her, I could always be sure she could breathe. I could just squeeze her a little bit, and when I released her, the sweet air would rush in to revive her. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.